All right. Okay. We are now recording.
So what did you do in Paris?
So when I was in Paris, this was back in 2001, early 2001. I was studying at the Paris Center for Critical Studies, which used to be the Paris Center for Film Studies, but then they had trouble attracting new students, so they broadened it a bit. But it was basically a film studies program. And that was one of my major interests in college before I went in a philosophical direction.
That means that you and I have something important in common, because we both got into philosophy after having been interested in film. So I got into philosophy for totally ridiculous reasons. I really wanted to be a filmmaker, but of course this was during my pretentious teenage years. So I wanted to make only deep film. And then I concluded foolishly that the best way to become deep, and therefore be in a position to make deep film, was by studying philosophy. Until I discovered that philosophy was something totally different.
That's really interesting, actually. That's sort of how I became interested in philosophy as well. I kind of became interested in philosophy via two routes. One was through linguistics, which raised all sorts of questions about, you know, what is the human language faculty, and how does it work, and why do we have it, and cockroaches don't have it, and so forth. But then I also became interested in philosophy because, well, in cinema studies, I was particularly interested in avant-garde cinema. I don't know if you came across that during your film years, but it's, for the listeners, it's very short, usually non-narrative, very, very, very low-budget films, independent films, done more on sort of the, you know, on the modernist model. So I was very interested in that. And a lot of the filmmakers who were part of this avant-garde film movement in America wrote these really interesting texts that came to be called theory. They're called, you know, sort of film theory texts. But actually, a lot of what they really were was philosophy. They were exploring these philosophical issues about, you know, what is the nature of a film strip, for example. So that would be like a metaphysical question that a lot of these filmmakers were interested in. What's the difference between a photograph and a painting? And this actually later became a topic discussed by philosophers, thanks to Stanley Cavell and Kendall Walton. But it was through engaging with the work of filmmakers who saw themselves as making films as a way of exploring philosophical problems, and then who also wrote about some of those philosophical problems.
I like your approach better, because mine was based on a total misunderstanding. So I wanted to be just like Andrei Tarkovsky. He was my man. And he gave me a sense that there was meaning to be sought, and I was sure that I would find it doing philosophy. But then, you know, I got interested in analytic philosophy and became convinced that the kind of meaning I was seeking is not to be found. But by then I had just fallen in love with logic and philosophy and just followed that route.
I see. So this is where your interest in Tractarianism, which perhaps we'll discuss in a minute, comes from, this idea that many philosophical problems are pseudo-problems, and rather than trying to answer them, we should instead take a step back and think about why we're asking them in the first place. And then once we see that we no longer need to ask them, maybe that's another thing we can do besides try to answer them.
You know, that had never occurred to me, but I think you're right. I think that my Carnapian and Tractarian tendencies are partly to do with the disillusion that I faced when I tried to find that kind of meaning in philosophy, and just got irritated by the proposals and felt like, you know, much of it was meaningless, and I wanted to be very careful to stick to the bits of philosophy that I thought that really did make sense, and reacted to the rest with the fury of the convert.
Oh, interesting. Well, I would encourage you at some point in the future to revisit the terrain of cinema, and with everything that you've learned about logic and language and human thought, and I think the results would be interesting.
I agree. Maybe this, of course, is a post-tenure pursuit, so maybe right. Now is the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's a question for you. Why did you decide to get your PhD in the U.S. instead of staying in France?
Oh, okay. Well, I actually wasn't stationed permanently in France. I was just doing a semester abroad there. And so I definitely considered getting a PhD in cinema studies, or whatever the equivalent, they call it a doctorate, I guess, in France. But I sort of had some qualms about some of the theoretical foundations of the film theory that they were doing in France. I'm actually not sure today whether that's fair, but at the time, I guess I haven't really explored it in that much depth. But at the time, I sort of felt like there was a lot of sort of reference to language, linguistics, math, and so forth being sort of thrown around but not really pursued in much depth and not in dialogue with actual linguists and mathematicians. And, you know, the engagement with these topics seemed to be a bit superficial and, you know, really more for show than actually out of an attempt to have a genuine collaboration with them.
That reminds me of something we were talking about before the show. You mentioned that now that you're spending time in Amsterdam, one of the things you're really happy about is that this is a place where you get experts in different fields collaborating. So it sounds like after all these years, you really have found what you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I haven't made a film in quite a while. It's did you make films when you were when you were aspiring to be a filmmaker?
I did, and I'll tell you about them. But first, I want you to tell me about your films.
Okay, so I made films in this sort of avant-garde vein. I made a few short films. One of them was a single frame animation, but it was sort of an animation. It wasn't exactly. That's probably the closest term you can use to approximate it. So with an animation, what you do is you like a claymation, for example, you would take, a figurine and then take a photograph, then move the figurine a little bit, take another photograph, move the figurine, take another photograph. And then when you play all the photographs back sequentially, it looks like the figurine is moving. This wasn't exactly that, but instead what it was I would take a picture of one thing that's circular and then take a picture of another totally different thing that's circular, but have the circle in the same place in the frame. So that what you get when you look at this is 24 frames a second of a bunch of circular things, but the circle is occupying the same space in the frame, and you're sort of given this tour through, the shape of circularity on the film.
Oh my God. It makes me sorry that this is radio and not television. It would be so nice to be able to see that.
Yeah, the video edition of Elucidations, hopefully forthcoming. Perhaps we'll... have some screenings. And so how about your film?
Well, I too did some stop motion, though I did do it with figurines. At first, when I started trying to do my own films, I had a terrific collaborator, and he was mostly interested in action films. So we did a lot of B, maybe even C action flicks. But as I
sort
started,
of in the Roberto Rodriguez vein, perhaps
that was our aspiration. Though, okay. Of course, ours were much worse. But as time went on, I really wanted to do something artsier, and really, I just wanted to be Tarkovsky. So what happened was that I moved away from my collaborator, and it was in some ways liberating. But I don't think that any of the projects I did on my own were as successful as the ones we did together. And in a way, that was the beginning of the end. It coincided with my starting to study philosophy and becoming interested in math and philosophy, and I sort of moved away.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, so one thing that I've found here, and I think this might be kind of hard for some people to identify with, but one thing I found studying at the ILLC here in Amsterdam is that there's a very definite aesthetic to the way they build up their formal frameworks and frame arguments and think about the issues and generally like the way they think about a topic. So if I'm going to write on this topic, I have to do this, this, and this. These are sort of my duties if I'm going to write about this topic. And there's really a whole aesthetic, I think, to laying all that stuff out that's kind of unique to Amsterdam. And I found that the best philosophy and linguistics and logic and so forth gives you the same sort of aesthetic pleasure as a great film or a great piece of music.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I can pin down the moment in which I fell in love with logic, and that was really the kind of philosophy I was doing. And it's when I finally understood Cantor's proof that there are just as many rational numbers as natural numbers. I thought it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen, and I think I was persuaded that I then knew that that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, well, there's the deep mysterious meaning of life stuff that you're looking for in Tarkovsky, I think, right there.
Yeah. Yes, except it wasn't quite what I was expecting.
Yeah.
But I did find the magic that I was looking for when I was watching these Tarkovsky films.
The philosopher-filmmaker career path is very much burgeoning. It's yet to be explored by that many people. The only filmmaker with a PhD in philosophy that I know of is a French fellow by the name of Serge Bozon.
Yes, I've heard of him. In fact, yeah. I may have even met him once. A recent PhD student at MIT where I work was friends with him when he did his master's in Paris. So I've certainly heard of him.
Okay, yeah. I've heard that he has a photographic memory and that he can just, you know, quote extensive passages from whatever, Leibniz or something, just from memory. Yeah. useful skill. But yeah, he's the only one I know of. And then there's sort of a half, maybe half case would be Terrence Malick, who started a PhD in philosophy at Oxford. I think it was under Ryle, but he ended up leaving over what sound anyway from, you know, reading on the internet, like ideological differences.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, with the Tree of Life, I think it's getting an Oscar nomination, isn't it? Yeah, perhaps the philosopher filmmaker is making a comeback.
That's right.
We'll see. We'll see.
So I'm curious to know more about how you decided to start making these podcasts.
Okay, well, so yeah, I guess the short answer is that I'm a complete podcast junkie, and I listening to them all the time. I think I'm subscribed to about 40 of them. I listen to them while I'm doing chores, washing the dishes, vacuuming, on the way to school, and so forth. So that, it doesn't actually take up any additional time. That's kind of the thing I love about podcasts. You can learn all this extra stuff, and it doesn't take any extra time. How often does that happen?
What's your favorite podcast?
That's a tough one. It changes a lot. Probably right now, my favorite podcast is it's called The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps. It's done by Peter Adamson at King's College London. I think he's about to move to Munich. But anyway, and I don't know if you've ever had the chance to listen to it, but it's really amazing, really comprehensive, really thorough, just history of philosophy. I guess there are two things I like about it. I mean, I haven't taken a look at the Kenny series that came out a couple of years ago, but it's just a really great in-depth reference on the history of philosophy. It's very much up to date, you know, just written in plain English that anybody can understand. It doesn't make undue use of philosophical jargon. And it's just really interesting. And he covers all these areas of philosophy that have sort of faded away from the philosophy curriculum. Like, for example, Hellenistic philosophy, which is what the podcast is covering now. And he does it very, very slowly. You know, for example, I think he had 18 episodes on Plato. And the first maybe 20 episodes of the podcast were on the pre-Socratics. And he's just going very, very slowly and trying not to skip stuff.
Wow.
So I think it's a really great resource for both amateur philosophers, professional philosophers, to really catch up on all that stuff they might have missed. I mean, I certainly never had the chance to study Epicureanism or, you know, academic skepticism or anything in any of my philosophy classes at school.
This bridging of the gap between amateurs and professionals is no easy task. And I think that philosophers could do much more by way of addressing that problem. My mother's an astronomer. And it's a constant reminder of how good astronomers are at sharing their ideas with the public. Anybody knows some of the basic fascinating facts about the universe. And philosophical research is no less interesting, and it's a shame that people don't know as much about philosophy as they know about the solar system.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, it seems like there's very much I think this has to do with the fact that there is sort of a popular science industry. You know, there are popular science magazines that you can read if you're curious about what the latest discoveries in physics and biology are, but don't have a BA in either of those fields. Creating some sort of venue for like a popular philosophy could be really helpful, you know, both to everybody else and to philosophy itself. We've been seeing this, unfortunately, in recent years, that a lot of philosophy departments have been threatened with being shut down or actually have been shut down. There's this, you know, debacle with the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. King's College at London tried to force a number of its professors into early retirement a few years ago. And I feel like that just wouldn't happen if people had a clue what philosophy was. It would be a lot less easy for some dean somewhere or some provost somewhere to decide to shut down the department if they knew what it was that philosophers were doing.
That's right. We need philosophical American as a counterpart to scientific American.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So one of my hopes with the podcast is to begin to create that kind of, you know, that kind of environment. But of course, I don't want to do it just by interviewing the public intellectual philosophers. I want to try and draw on as many of the philosophy professors who maybe haven't ever, you know, done an interview, written a popular publication, gone on the radio before. You know, I think that has the potential to give the podcast a certain kind of freshness and make it, you know, an accurate picture of what philosophers in the university are actually doing.
You know? I'm curious to know who was your first interviewee and an example of an interview that went particularly well.
Well, so first chronologically or first in the order that we released the episode?
Chronologically,
So my first one, I got pretty lucky with my first one. My first one was Brian Leiter, who is, he's really a lot of fun to interview. He's a big tease. He's very playful and he's a big tease. You know, he's cracking lots of jokes and, you know, very, very eloquent speaker, and he's very comfortable being interviewed. He's done that a lot before. So for me, doing my first ever interview, you know, no interview experience before, it was really great to have somebody who was just, you know, very, very comfortable in that.
That's right.
In that environment. And what was the other question?
I wanted an example of an interview you're especially proud of, or one that went especially well.
One that went especially well. Well, I really liked the one that we did with Brandon Fogel on, so the title of the episode, I think it was episode 18, on action at a distance in the history of physics. The actual title of the episode was Mechanism and Causation. But what we talked about was the way that different physicists over time have responded to the idea or reacted to the idea that a body could somehow influence another body without touching it, or without touching anything in between the two bodies. And yeah, it was just a really, really fascinating episode. And it was one case where I think some potentially very difficult technical material was explained in a really, you know, intuitive, eye-opening way. He started off by talking about a magic trick, which I thought was a great way to way into the topic. You know, sort of a magic trick as way into questions about puzzling phenomena and how do we explain them. So yeah, that's one example that
very
jumps
cool.
to mind.
Very cool.
So would you like to talk a little bit about your forthcoming book?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the first thing to mention is its title. It's called The Construction of Logical Space. And it has taken a long time to get it ready. So I've been working on it for 5 years. And now, finally, it looks like it's going to come out. So I'm very, very excited. It has been sometimes a labor of love and sometimes a tale of great frustration. But I'm very excited about it.